Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Avid NPR listeners will be familiar with the name Robert Wood Johnson Foundation because RWJF has been a longtime underwriter of the network. Based in Princeton, New Jersey, the foundation is the country's largest philanthropy focused solely on health. The foundation's goal through the use of grants is to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. It has $11 billion in assets, generating grants that approach $500 million a year. RWJF was founded in 1972 upon a bequest of stock from Robert Wood Johnson II, who died in 1968 and was responsible for building the family firm Johnson & Johnson into the world's largest health products maker. Over the last several years, RWJF has simplified its singular vision to creating a culture of health in the United States. The foundation makes grants for a range of health issues, including access to care, childhood obesity, health insurance coverage, healthcare cost, quality, and value, leadership for better health, and something it calls a pioneer portfolio, which makes grants to promote approaches to entrench problems, identify emerging health issues, and build new models for providing care. My guest today, Lori Melikar, is a senior director and the team lead of the Pioneer Portfolio. Her job involves scanning the country to find innovative ideas that have the potential to be scalable to address both gaps in care and disparate outcomes. Equity is a core value of the foundation. Melikar has a PhD in labor economics from the University of Maryland, and she hails from Tulsa, where she grew up as the daughter of two physicians and attended Tulsa Public Schools. Lori Melikar, senior director at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Lori Melikar, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you just give us the big picture of Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It's a foundation I think many listeners have heard of. You underwrite many initiatives, and that tagline, culture of health, which is the vision or mission, is something that resonates with a lot of people. Give us the big picture of Robert Wood Johnson.
So the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, you hear about us the most on NPR. That's where we get, I think, the most of our traction. We're almost an $11 billion foundation now. We're the largest foundation that's devoted exclusively to improving health and healthcare. We, over a 40-year history, have really evolved from a foundation that really focused on trying to improve the healthcare system to a foundation that concentrates a majority of our efforts on trying to address the social determinants of health. We're understanding more and more that what determines our health, certainly the health system, is very, very important, and there are a lot of efforts still going on to make sure that care is centered around patients' goals and needs. But also, very increasingly, we're trying to understand how we can support communities across the country, how we can make sure that healthy kids and healthy families have the support that they need to really raise healthy kids. We're thinking a lot about the leadership, national leadership, but also local leadership to make sure that our future, those working in the healthcare system but also outside, are really supported and working. We talk about our efforts to build a culture of health, and everyone has kind of a different interpretation about that, what that means. For some, they like to say you make the healthy choice the easy choice. Others like to talk about just health first or health in all policies. But we really want people to always be thinking about health as they're making decisions that affect members of their community.
Can you give a contrast? You mentioned that, I guess, a while ago, the foundation looked at health care, healthcare systems. Like, so what are some differences between then and now in terms of grantees? Or, I mean, you mentioned social determinants, which I think many of our listeners will be familiar with. But just for the sake of it, I mean, what are some examples?
Yeah, so our work has evolved over the last 40 years. And I wouldn't say that we're not funding work that we would have funded before, but just certainly there's an increase in the attention and the investments we're making outside. So an example would be that we have made an investment in an organization. I saw examples of their work here in Tulsa called Purpose Built Communities, which is a national organization, has a national model, and is doing work in communities to make sure that efforts to educate young children, efforts to house families, efforts to make sure that people and families have access to parks and food and exercise and having safe places to spend outside of their home, that those are all coordinated, and recognizing that that's all part of a package to support a healthy life. We're especially also focused on health equity, and in particular, we're focused on racial equity. So where there's also an opportunity in these communities to really focus in and really kind of have as your North Star health equity, that's something that we have over the years really increasingly focused on. So Purpose Built would be an example of a kind of grant that we as a national foundation would make that is doing work in communities across the country that are interested in this kind of holistic model to support the whole person.
And is an example of that is Kendall Whittier Community or Growing Together is an example of a grant recipient of purpose-built communities or works with purpose-built communities?
So we have not made a grant to Kendall Whittier or to the Growing Together. They serve as what purpose-built calls community quarterback, who really kind of coordinates all the different efforts that are happening across. Our grant would be to the national organization that would then use those funds to provide the kind of technical assistance that communities like Kendall Whittier and other communities across the country would need.
So $11 billion sounds like quite a bit, and your sole focus is on health, but with other like health equity you mentioned. So how does the foundation divvy up its work? And for example, I know you are over innovation programming, mm-hmm. but I mean, there are many other different divisions, if you want to call them that, or what do you guys call them?
Yeah, so we call them themes, which is kind of a wonky term for it. But a lot of our work, so we, for many years, also have really taken great pride and also been appreciated for being an evidence-based foundation. So we have a very large department of research and evaluation that in our earlier days did a lot of evaluations of demonstration programs. A lot of our work now is trying to build the research base so that we can do evidence-based strategies to build a culture of health. And that work really, I think, spans the gamut of what the foundation's program teams are working on now and also what we might be working on in the future. We try to be really strategic. And so we talk about our work as organized in four themes, as I said. The vast majority of our funding is either allocated towards transforming health and healthcare systems, which is focused not only on what we typically think of the healthcare system, but also trying to make sure that healthcare systems are linked to public health activities and also social services, focused on patients' goals and needs with a strong equity focus. Healthy communities, so the work I was talking about related to purpose-built would be an example of that, really trying to understand what it takes to foster healthy communities, trying to understand what kinds of mindsets need to be shifted for different agencies and actors in a community that may think that they are about housing, but to help them see that they are also about health, so really trying to get everyone focused on those goals. Healthy kids and families, which is really trying to understand and shift mindsets again related to, in particular, policies that support healthy kids and families and make it easier for families to get their kids the supports that they need. And then the fourth is leadership. So we have a range of leadership programs. Some of them fund postdocs who are doing work, particularly related to health equity. Some of them fund clinicians to try to encourage them to explore topics related to health that are outside of what they would typically encounter in a public health or a medical or nursing curriculum. We also support leaders in communities who may not have health or anything medical related to their title. We really recognize that the work that they're doing to organize communities is really focused on health. So try to provide technical assistance, trying to provide cohorts for them, and any other kinds of supports to help is, again, try to make sure the leadership of the future is really prepared to address the challenges that may emerge. So the challenges that may emerge is my department. So I have a smaller group at the foundation. We sometimes talk about it as the innovation unit or the group that's really charged with anticipating the future of health and, in particular, the work of the foundation. We expect to be – we have $11 billion. We don't spend a lot of that. We spend about $500 million a year, which is a lot of money. But we really expect to be around for perpetuity. So we need to be thinking about what the foundation is going to be working on in the future. So part of our work is to try to understand that culture, we're trying to build a culture of health. Culture is always emerging. Sometimes it's really easy to see when culture there's an event that's going to change culture. More often, culture is really emerging slowly. And so our job is to try to identify emerging trends, so trends that are just now starting, in fact, many that may or may not be trends, and that's kind of part of our work to do some work to anticipate or try to understand which things are really trends or which, whether they be technological, scientific, cultural changes are actually just kind of not going to be longstanding. And then we do some work to try to understand whether that trend will affect the future of health, the future of the foundation, in particular, health equity. So as an example, a couple of years ago when folks were really just starting to talk about artificial intelligence as a possible reality, it's kind of hard to imagine. There was a time not that long ago where we actually had to do interviews with 50 people to say, how might this be useful for health? And got a lot of experts to kind of think with us about how it might be used in, for example, precision medicine, how it might be used with diagnostics, a lot of things they didn't predict that we're now also thinking about relate to health equity. By understanding the potential for artificial intelligence to affect healthcare in particular, we were able to fund a study that Khadija Ferryman did when she was a fellow at Data and Society, an organization in New York City, to try to understand the equity implications of precision medicine and to try to identify where bias might be baked into the kinds of algorithms that eventually will be really determining a lot of our care. So very early on, before actually even before the NIH had funded a lot of the All of Us initiative, we had a report that identified potential bias that might lead to health inequities, additional inequities. And then through a couple of strategic opportunities and just kind of luck opportunities, Khadija ended up being placed on the IRB for the NIH All of Us initiative. So in that position, was able to review all of the research proposals that come into that initiative to be able to identify where there might be and identify opportunities to reduce bias that could have been baked into a system that will affect the way that care is provided in the future. So wow. It's a great example of trying to get in there early. You know, artificial intelligence may or may not have turned into what it has turned into, but really trying to do the scenario planning, think into the future, and then if it's a trend that we think is going to affect health equity for the worse, to try to do something to mitigate that trend. If it's a trend we think might enhance health equity or enhance health and healthcare, and the Maker movement is a good example of that, then we try to harness that trend to improve health.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Lori Melikar, who is a team director at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation based in New Jersey, but a national foundation dedicated to improving America's health and creating a culture of health. And Lori, we were talking about your sphere, looking at innovations. And so I was able to find on the website. So tell us about the Maker Nurse program. This was a program that your team funded, right, or supported?
Yes. So we do work, as I was mentioning, to try to understand emerging trends. And in some cases, as with an example related to precision medicine, we try, when we see that an emerging trend might impact health for the worse or perhaps increase health inequities, we try to do work to mitigate that trend. If we see a trend that actually might help accelerate our progress towards a culture of health, then we try to really harness, we say, that trend and try to bring it in, particularly when it's a trend that's happening outside of healthcare or outside of the health spheres we're working in. We try to make grants to experiment with bringing it into health. So a great example of that is the Maker movement. So right now, again, it's hard to imagine that this was ever an emerging trend that nobody had ever heard of. There was a time when there was a Maker Faire in New York City, but nobody else had heard about Maker Spaces. There certainly weren't fab labs everywhere. It was really a quirky place. And in fact, three or four of the foundation staff went to a Maker Faire, and three of the four came back and said, there's nothing here for health.
Really?
You know,
wow.
There's printers, there's robots, there's arts and crafts, but this is just a very niche community, very cool, but nothing here for health. One of my colleagues was there and actually met Jose Gomez Marquez and Anna Young, who are at MIT, and talked to them about their work that they had done and their observation. Jose, in particular, when he was going to developing countries, he would find just amazing ingenuity by the medical staff who were creating nebulizers out of bicycle pumps. They were doing what they could with what they had and really creating amazing innovations. And he said more often than not, though, a physician would show him the amazing innovation. When he probed deeper to see who did it, it would be the nurse who was too embarrassed to come forward and was really humble and who was really the innovator.
The doctor is, of course, happy to take the credit, right?
well, you know, the doctor probably helped them get to the nurse. But it was this idea that there are maker nurses in developing countries, and certainly there are maker nurses in hospitals. So I would say this was kind of a hunch that we kind of came to together. We connected with Jose and Anna. We funded some initial work just to find maker nurses. So they went out to hospitals. They did work to build trust, to say who's really doing cool things. They then found these nurses. And then the intent was to understand, why are you a maker nurse? And for us to understand, what makes a maker nurse? Is it just who you are? So some people, if their dryer breaks, their dryer door breaks, will go order a new piece that cost $80 to fix it. Others will find some Sugru or some duct tape, and they'll figure out a way to make it themselves. My father's a maker. I'm the one who buys the piece. He's the one who will jerry-rig something to make something work. So was it just that they were makers and some people weren't? Was it that some nurses had managers who were really supportive of their innovation? Was it just that some nurses had fewer resources and were less able to get things fixed or get new products than others? And we found out that it was really a combination of these factors, to be sure, but really that there were just people who are makers, and some of them turn out to be nurses. And these nurses are different from entrepreneurs. So entrepreneurs are creative and inventing things, and certainly nurse entrepreneurs need to be supported. But nurse entrepreneurs often are interested in benefiting financially from their innovation, as they should. Nurse makers can't help but share. So they've figured out something, they've solved a problem, they want it used by as many people as possible right away. We even, there was a story that Jose tells about two nurses they found in the same hospital who had both separately invented the same kind of similar wound care to be used in the NICU, so adapting bandages so that it could be useful in the NICU. One was sharing it and hoping that it would get used widely. Another was kind of had it in a drawer, mm-hmm. hidden away until she got her patent on it. So the idea there, trying to understand not only what made someone a maker nurse, but then also how could we best support maker nurses across the country. So then their second phase of their work was to actually build a maker space in a hospital. And this was something, again, it's hard to imagine that this was really challenging, but we were really nervous that we weren't going to be able to make this happen, that the IP concerns of the hospital, the other legal liability concerns would really get in the way, and really found that in a hospital in Massachusetts and in Texas, they built a makerspace where nurses collaborated with physicians who collaborated with folks who were fixing things, repair people who worked in a hospital, and really creating really amazing innovations to help their patients across the hospital.
So in a sense, Robert Wood Johnson funds the Maker Nurse movement or program, which is maybe a nonprofit or is some kind of organization that then goes out and finds these places in America or in the world, for example, where making stuff is going on, where there's innovation.
That's a helpful tool to help me explain how we do our work. So the Pioneer portfolio, again, I said it's a relatively small portfolio. We fund work to experiment. I wouldn't even go so far as to say we demonstrate, because we often don't we don't do work even that's going to create some kind of randomized control trial, any kind of evidence that something is working. Our group is especially positioned to give folks, to help people prototype. So if they have an idea, just to see what it might look like. So in this example, we supported the work of the team at MIT to do the research and to build the two makerspaces. They then have actually created a company that supports healthcare systems across the country and builds pop-up makerspaces, helps them create more permanent makerspaces in healthcare facilities, and it kind of has a life of its own. That's a great success story.
Right, I was
going
to say, you seed funded it and it took off, and it's sustainable on its own now.
It is. And you know, there were a lot of factors that made that possible. Disappointingly for us, because we also try to make sure that we're always experimenting with new ideas, we don't tend to provide funding to scale and spread projects, even others that, and so there are examples, sadly, of projects that were also successful that haven't really spread, that we can capture as an idea and hope that others will also will learn from that and will try to implement the ideas themselves. But we're not always as successful as we were with that grant.
So the Pioneering Ideas is the name of the portfolio, which mm-hmm. are really these innovation grants. So how big is your team?
So people-wise?
Yeah.
We're kind of in flux. I would say that we have 4 to 5 program staff. So mm-hmm. these are folks, and I kind of include myself in that category. We're a couple of hats, who go out to communities, who go to innovation meetings, who attend meetings of folks outside of health and healthcare, trying to meet people, try to understand and identify emerging trends, and trying to talk with people about the ideas that they have. And then they'll bring those ideas back to the foundation for consideration for funding. We also have an open portal, meaning that anyone can send us their idea at any time. We're about to close it for the year on October 15th, but that'll be open in January, and it's open year-round. And the staff that I mentioned read 3 or 4 of us read every single idea that comes in the door. And then I think we want to get better at really conveying how we don't fund a lot of those that come in the door. We get a lot of we're the only open portal for the foundation, and so we get a lot of work that's not especially aligned to our goals. But there certainly have been several ideas that have come in just kind of unsolicited. We're really proud of the fact that the foundation is open to pioneering ideas from anyone at every at any time. I will say we give preference to nonprofits. Our tax code makes it challenging for us to give grants to for-profit organizations, but we will work with organizations sometimes to understand charitable purpose, and so it's not a no-go. But probably a year ago, we received an unsolicited proposal from Erica Walker. In Boston. She had heard about our work just from a magazine article and kind of Googled the foundation and wasn't really sure where her idea might fit in the work that I identified at the top of the podcast as being our priority areas. Sent her proposal to us for consideration. And Erica was concerned with the challenge of noise equity, which is something that made us say, that's interesting. That wasn't something that we'd thought of. But immediately we could understand how noise can affect health. I live in New York City. I live in a neighborhood that is a nice neighborhood to live in. And regularly my sleep is interrupted by noise on the street from people going to restaurants, from motorcycles, from sirens. That's a little bit early in the morning. Okay. We hear the subway too, but it's the middle of the night stuff that really gets you. Really resonated with me, but also with others. As I said, three or four of us read all of these ideas. So what Erica wants to do is to understand the challenge and convey the challenge of noise equity. So a lot of cities, municipalities have laws related to noise, but many of them only relate to how loud the noise is, how many decibels, don't take into account whether a noise is especially annoying or troubling, doesn't take into account vibration, such as a train or a flight path. And there are many other kind of characteristics of noise that would be really helpful when you're trying to think about how to prioritize your resources to try to get rid of something. So she had a pioneering idea and also gave us another opportunity to explore the emerging trend of citizen science. So she has an app that she is allowing citizen scientists across the country, citizens really, to put on their phone to measure, record noise in their city. And with this data, she, number one, hopes to be able to understand the distribution of noise within a city, which could be really useful for policymakers, but also to actually create new measures of noise that could be really helpful for, again, policymakers who are thinking about, so we have a noise equity problem, what can we do about it? And so it's work that we think can be really impactful and, importantly, just made us think, and as we talk about it with others, think about health in a new way. And actually, you can hear about this work. We partnered with Man Made Music, who partnered with 99% Invisible. So Roman Mars has a podcast about noise in the city and also noise in the hospital that highlights this grantee.
I have not heard this, but I am a Roman Mars fan. I will definitely check those out. That's really interesting. So wait, did you say how the app works? You hold up the app and it tells you the noise level or something?
No, I think you record it. Uh-huh. And I actually haven't used it. I should download it and use it in my own house. But my understanding is that you're recording. And with the GPS, it also gives the location of the noise.
Wow.
So then she collects this data and she's analyzing
it. Got it. Oh, very interesting.
So in some ways, I'm sure there are going to be new opportunities to use this data that we hadn't even really thought about.
So, Lori, I want to shift gears for a second here and just highlight the fact that you grew up in Tulsa.
I did.
You are a native Tulsan, and we were lucky enough to catch you when you were in town here working with Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Tell us a little bit about your background. You grew up here, went to Booker T. Washington High School?
I did. I went to Emerson Elementary, Carver Middle School, and then Booker T. Had a great experience. Went to the East Coast for college and found it really challenging to adjust to that East Coast mentality, and then spent a couple years there and kind of got used to it. went to D.C. after that and then ended up marrying someone who I met in the they called it Quaker Matchbox at the Quaker school where I went to college. A lot of people end up together, and we ended up on the East Coast. So I've been living in New York City, which also is just a city I've really grown to love for the past 17 or so years.
Uh-huh.
Coming back, my father still lives in Tulsa, and coming back to visit him as often as I can. I recently came back in March when we met because I really, in the capacity of my job, I really wanted to understand how health was being produced in Tulsa, in the healthcare system, but also in the communities that the community I experienced, but also communities that I didn't spend a lot of time in when I was here, and also looking for innovation and people with pioneering ideas. So we looked at, we have an open portal. We get a lot of ideas from the East Coast and the West Coast. We don't get a lot of ideas from Oklahoma, and was really hoping to identify some pioneers who might have ideas, but also really get the word out. So as you are talking to people who have neat ideas, you can say, you know, you should check in with Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and send their ideas, your ideas their way. And, you know, even if we can't fund everything, everything that we read helps us learn and helps us understand either about something that's happening in a community or kind of shifts our perspective in some way. So we get a lot out of reading those ideas.
In your background, it says your doctoral degree, you're a labor economist.
Yes.
So how does that tie in? It's just that you are bright, obviously, but labor economics, does that involve, well, a little bit of labor history, I suppose, but it's economics. So I suppose it's relevant certainly to health or culture of health,
yeah.
Right? I mean, health is, if nothing, not laborious.
Yes. Well, yes, I guess so. I grew up in a household, I'm the daughter of two physicians. My father was a surgeon at St. John's, and my mother was an internist at Moton and then Morton in North Tulsa. So certainly was always hearing about health and the challenges that they were experiencing and what the trends were in health. So that was kind of my background. I went to college and economics appealed to me. I went and got a PhD in economics. Labor in particular, I was interested in more microeconomics and understanding what motivated workers and how you could really incentivize them. And any work that I did ended up being related to the healthcare system. So my dissertation was trying to understand whether physicians spent less time with their capitated patients than with their non-capitated patients.
Wow.
It turns out they did.
They spent less time with their basically an HMO patient as opposed to somebody, right, okay, interesting.
Yeah, which makes sense from a labor economist kind of point of view. And then when I went to the foundation, I found myself, I mentioned we have a Department of Research and Evaluation. I found myself, my home there was in evaluation. So I was helping to evaluate programs. At that time, there was a nursing shortage, and the foundation was very interested in the nursing shortage and trying to understand why there was a nursing shortage. So I got involved in that work and really came to understand that there was so much work studying physicians and understanding why physicians made decisions the way they did and trying to influence their behavior, and so much opportunity to do the same with nurses, that there were a lot of nurse researchers who were doing good work, but that was getting published. It was being done by nurses, published in nursing journals, read by other nursing leaders, but really this work on physicians was getting a much broader audience. And partly it was because of the journals it was getting published in, but also because economists who weren't health economists, political scientists, sociologists were also looking at the data that was being captured and shared about physicians. So started a program called Inquiry, which required interdisciplinary partnerships between provider, a nurse, and then someone from another discipline, and to do work related to understanding how nursing quality is produced and how that contributes to outcomes in healthcare, under the theory that if we could really capture the contributions nurses make to quality, then it might be a little easier for hospital administrators to allocate more funding to making sure that nurses were empowered at the bedside to really lead quality improvement efforts. So I kind of came in as a researcher, was really attracted and found a home in the work of nurses. You can see that eventually translated to work on Maker Nurse because I was really attracted to the idea. I knew a lot about hospitals and really how ingenious nurses were and what a value it was to having them lead quality as well as physicians and other kinds of providers. And then it's a big place. I've spent time working on a lot of issues. I found a home on the Pioneer team as a member, bringing some kind of innovative research methodologies to that group. And then I've really found it hard to leave. It's been a great place to learn a lot about a lot of different things.
Well, I have definitely learned a lot and, of course, have a million more questions, but it's been a joy to talk to you. Lori Melikar is a labor economist and senior director of the Pioneering Ideas Program at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.